The following program is for entertainment and basic informational purposes only. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of Cumulus Media, WPRV Radio, its management, or staff. This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we made it. Believe it or not, and I don't say that as a joke. How long did it take us to get here from Lincoln, Rhode Island?
You sound a little bit out of breath. Did you run here from Lincoln?
I ran the whole way.
You might have gotten here
or
faster.
Or at very least from the parking lot downstairs.
It took us a solid hour.
Yeah, to get from Lincoln up around the, you know, area not far from Davies.
It was solid. Right, 146, right solid through up 195.
Is this a Rhode Island thing? I don't understand. I mean, when I get into that kind of traffic, I want to get down there and see body bags.
I mean,
it's a
terrible.
I mean, you better get down there. You better see. Actually, half the time when I am in that experience, like even on 95, when you're just in a parking lot, and then you finally get down to the area that's causing it, and it's on the other side of the road.
It's that rubbernecking.
And all you're dealing with the people who are rubbernecking. Well, then I really feel like pulling my hair out, and I can't afford to pull any more hair out than
you
I already have.
You don't have much to pull out.
I'll do my beard.
It's
maybe I can
true.
Pull on the beard, but
it's true.
Well, guess what, folks?
But you made it.
Despite all the
and
negativity, this is pre-holiday negativity. You know, the stock market ended higher, didn't it?
First time ever that the S&P has closed above 2,600. You know, every day that it goes up, you hear the phrase again, closing at an all-time high. And remember, all it takes is a point here or a point there higher to get you to that new all-time high. But sometimes there are thresholds that are, whether they are technical thresholds or psychological thresholds, 2,600 being one of them, on the S&P, where people say, oh, we've crossed that threshold.
Well, the 2599 was actually still a closing high. But apparently,
I'm sorry, it crossed midday.
But they said that
though,
it actually did briefly go through 26, which is one of those nice round psychological numbers. I mean, I'm sure that there are people that are out there that would much rather say, well, 2,700, you know, on the S&P. But the tech sector really
definitely drove it.
The tech they have the exchange traded fund category, which kind of mirrors, it's like a basket of technology stocks. As part of the S&P tech sector, did very well. It reached levels not seen literally since the year 2000. So
you saw the biggest gains today on the NASDAQ, which is very tech heavy.
And by the way, when the S&P is doing well, being a blue chip index, the ultimate blue chip index is still the Dow. When people say, I find that amazing considering the lack of breadth that exists in the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It's 30 companies.
Very concentrated.
But in fairness to them, I think that the people at Dow Jones, the company, are very, very attentive to the importance of the companies that make up the Dow. They really, really want that 30 companies, usually they're very large, but they want that 30 to be reflective of what does the U.S.
What does the U.S. economy look like?
What is this what's going on in the U.S. economy? So the Dow was up 160. The tech-heavy NASDAQ, obviously composite, is going to be much more driven by when the tech is big. And it rose more than 1% today, hitting its own all-time high. So large-cap tech stocks like the ones you know and love, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix,
ones
Alphabet.
Ones that are frankly starting to make up a fairly large part of the S&P 500 as
well. Needless to say, they were all higher. Alphabet was the top-performing, not Alphabet, Apple. Top performing stock in the Dow. And by the way, if somebody was talking to me about the Dow Jones, they said it's not just how innovative or the stock prices that make up those companies. It's the fact that all 30 of them can be viewed by economists as well as market strategists as being important. Mm-hmm. Important companies, they drive parts of the market, they drive parts of the economy. Medtronic, Hormel Foods, Dollar Tree all posted better than expected quarterly results as well today. After that was before the bell. That sent the stocks really higher at the very end. It's amazing you get to the end and that. I remember they'll go to one of the floor traders right at the very end of the end of the session at around 4 o'clock, and the floor trader will say, they said, well, you know, it looks like we're going to finish up the Dow in the green. And they go, I don't really know. We have right now about 100,000 or 250,000 sell orders that haven't cleared. In other words, the market closes technically at 4, which means they accept no more orders. But all of the ones that are in the pipeline have to actually clear. And so it takes, I tell people, I say, look, wait 3 or 4 minutes then.
Yeah.
I mean, it's better than it used to be. It used to be 10 minutes, but now it's 3 or 4 minutes to actually clear anything in the queue. And then, you know, you can come up with a number and say, so we've seen cases where at exactly 4 when the bell rang, when the Dow was in positive territory, but 3 or 4 minutes later, it just fell below. But
isn't that why you always say when someone asks you, what's the market doing at 3 at like noon, lunchtime?
Yeah.
You're like, I don't know. Ask me in a few hours. Yeah, that would be it. But, you know, we're getting to the end of earnings season, and we've seen a lot of companies posting numbers that were better than expected. So as we are here, you know, in the fourth quarter, getting to the end of the year, that continues to have a positive effect. It continues to bode well for stocks. So even where we, you know, maybe typically would see a slump this time of year or a pullback this time of year, we haven't seen that yet. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but we haven't, you know, seen it yet.
Well, we've got to get some people here on at the end of the year, maybe our good pal from our economist,
Brad McMillan. That's right.
You know, Brad's promised. He says we're going to make an effort to get him in here in the next few weeks. He's a senior economist, has been in the business a long time. But you know what the thing I love about Brad is that he's this realist. Yeah, I mean, prognosticators love to offer you projections as to what will be, what can be, what might be. But he'll explain to you his rationale. But I find that if I look back over the last couple of years, he was always reliable, meaning that he didn't stick his neck out so far that it could be literally chopped off. But he wouldn't typically
He's never been overly optimistic about anything. So.
Well, you know, and he's not negative. Interestingly, he's not bearish right now. I mean,
no, he's not.
Even with markets reaching pretty close to, I mean, they're. People say, well, the market's at an all-time high. It's almost always at an all-time high. Unless
Every time it goes up a little bit.
When you are in a bear market, yes, you'll pull back from those all-time highs. But when you're in a bull market, and let's face it, since the recession in 07 and 08, starting in about April or so of 09, we have been in a bull market ever since, which means pretty much you're going to be at all-time highs each and every period.
Interesting. All-time high is not a negative phrase. If your expectation is that if you put money in the market now, in 10 years from now, it will be higher, then you're expecting that then it will be at an all-time high. You expect it to grow, to continually go higher. So it is not a negative phrase. Now, if the economy is overheated, if stocks are very, very expensive, if you're looking at their P.E. ratios, then that is something to be concerned about.
Now, the only piece that I have bought into that's here at the end that's part of that world of prognostication is, yes, the president is suggesting
that
the American people are going to get a big, big, huge tax cut Christmas gift. If that does not happen, I expect a 2-3% pullback in the market, which will be the last week of December or the first week of January.
There's something like 14 working days left for Congress.
And
right?
By the way, I could see that pullback happening in that time frame for a lot of different reasons. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about some of those reasons, some of the things that people do, that market participants do at year end, maybe some of the things you should be doing here at UEnd as you look at your investment decisions and your financial planning decisions for year end and for the start of 2018. This is the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program with Donna Sowa Allard and myself. I'm Don Sowa. We'll be right back.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the Money Talk Get Back to Basics program with Donna Allard and Don Sowa. That's me. We're talking about some of the strategies that are part of the year-end thinking. A lot of things happen at year-end. There's a lot of mechanical events taking place within the investment world. You know the old adage that the rich get richer? Well, sometimes the rich are particular stocks. Some stocks, because of the success that they've enjoyed all year, may in fact do even better immediately at year end. Part of that falls into the category of window dressing. Big institutional money managers that manage big, even private portfolios, hedge funds and the like, that manage billions of dollars, What they do is they have to put together a year-end report for their investors. And part of that year-end report is going to include a list of everything that they own at year-end. They mark the portfolio to the market. Now, I've actually listened to some of these money managers talk about this, and they said the last thing on the planet you want to do is have to sit down with your potential with your existing clients sometimes and literally have to explain to them why they don't own in this portfolio some of the super-duper high-flying best stocks of the year. Right now, it wouldn't shock anyone if you pull that if that investor looks at their portfolio and they do not own one of the FANGs, the Facebooks and the Apples and the Netflix and the Googles of the world, any of those guys. If they don't, they say, wait a minute, why am I paying you, Mr. Money Manager, all of this money and I don't own any of these things? Well, shouldn't be shocking that many of the blue chip companies, large cap growth and large cap value funds that exist today, including even some of the exchange traded funds in that category. If you look at the top 10 holdings in most of them, don't be shocked if they own some of the stocks I just mentioned. They own quite a few of them. But the private money managers may be doing things different. Another thing that's a big part of year end, of course, is issues related to tax planning. Nobody likes paying more in taxes than they have to, but that is exactly what oftentimes happens for average investors. And here at year end is the time when you should be figuring out if you're one of them.
And you are probably an average investor. I'm just going to put that out there for you.
Wow.
Most of us retail investors are average investors. If you have after-tax accounts, meaning that this is money that you have earned and you made a contribution to an investment account from your checking account, so you've already paid taxes on it, and this money has grown and you decided to sell something somewhere throughout the year, if you did it this year, you probably have a taxable gain. Now, you're going to owe capital gains taxes on the earnings.
Now, by the way, just as an aside, this is for taxable investment portfolios, not IRAs?
Yes, that is what I said. An after-tax investment account,
well, I guess yes. What's in that water I'm drinking over here? Maybe that drive-in here just shook me up too much.
After-tax investment account that you paid taxes on, you will owe capital gains. You'll probably owe capital gains at this point because most of your investments probably have gains in them this year, but it's possible that you could have something with a loss. So if you are looking to offset some of your gains with a loss, you may look to, it's called tax loss harvesting. You may look to go in and sell something at a loss to offset the gain.
Wait a minute, Allard. You're telling me that the U.S. tax code actually provides planning opportunities for taxable investors when capital investments lose value?
The tax code actually provides a plethora of opportunities for people to take advantage of, and that's why accountants will always, always, always be in business.
There are some investors who will look at, and especially if they think they're decently good quality companies that may have just gone through a bit of a downturn, maybe I'll just hold on to these until they come back. But maybe in that particular account, by being a little bit more proactive, you can actually take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. Even if it's a temporary decline, you can always buy it back, right?
It is. I was just going to say, and if it's a stock that you like long-term but happen to have a loss in right now, you can go in, I believe it's 60 days from now, and go in and repurchase it and hold it for the future as a long-term investment. Another opportunity is if you have a capital loss that you're carrying over from a previous year, you're allowed to carry over, I believe it's up to $3,000 per year of that loss to offset current gains that you have. So take a look at what you have. Maybe talk to your accountant or your tax preparer and see if there's an opportunity for a past loss that you have on the books, or if there's something currently in your portfolio, and see if you might be able to offset some gains if you have some realized gains in an after-tax account.
No, for the most part, we're probably talking about, although it's not exclusive, but talking about long-term capital losses,
right,
to offset long-term capital gains, which are what? What's long-term?
Long-term is if you've held it for more than a year. If you've held it for less than a year, that's considered short-term capital gains, and they're going to be taxed at ordinary income tax rates. However, they can't be offset against long-term losses.
Well, and now, so here we are talking about the stock market, but if you owned a piece of property for a number of years up in, say, Cape Cod, and you sold that finally, but for whatever reason you were selling at a loss, and that will happen. If your CPA,
when you bought it, certainly.
Yeah,
good.
Depending, your tax preparer tells you that, you've got some capital losses there. Number one, you want to find out how much you have in capital, long-term capital losses, and look to see if you have any long-term capital gains. This may be a time to actually adjust your portfolio to take some of those taxable gains off the books, given that you have all these losses that you can work with.
And, you know, even if you didn't sell anything to generate a realized gain, there's a very good chance that this year mutual funds you owned have had distributions. Mm-hmm. So if the fund itself had a distribution, then you could own some, you could owe some taxes on that.
Yeah, remember something, a mutual fund portfolio, especially the active managers, part of what they're doing is they're buying and selling on your behalf consistent with the prospectus, which is the booklet that you get with the investment initially, which tells you what the goal of the investment is, what their priorities are, and how they manage the money. If it's an active manager, it's entirely possible that they see a really good, what has been a hot stock for them in the portfolio, but maybe they feel it's now run its course and it's time to sell that and use the proceeds of that sale to purchase the next great opportunity in the plan. But what does that create when that happens?
So that creates a capital gain that's realized, and then it is distributed to people who own the fund, like you and me.
A warning, if you are buying a fund for the first time, it would always be helpful to purchase that fund after they've distributed the capital losses. Many times your money manager can access that information and find out for you. The last thing you want to do is purchase a fund
right,
and then almost and subsequently they distribute capital gains. Remember, the capital gains that they're distributing are for a lengthy period of time that money has been growing. You get out and all of a sudden they're distributing that. So that taxable gain is going to be taxed to you, even though the value of your account, which you just purchased, is not technically going up.
It.
So you're paying taxes on money you really didn't earn.
Yeah, that's a bummer. I always say to
that's
clients,
a terrible
if, you,
thing.
if you're paying capital gains taxes, it's probably because you made money. But what you just described is a situation where that would not apply and would not feel quite as good.
Now, if you have some embedded capital losses elsewhere that you're carrying forward, you might be able to get rid of it that year. But you'd hate to waste capital gain tax opportunities.
Certainly.
You know, you'd hate to waste them on something that didn't really have a major benefit for you. The other thing, too, that about the capital gains world is that if you have to incur a tax for selling something, you want to make sure that you've owned it at least the 12 months.
Yeah, because you want to be taxed if you have to be taxed, you want to be taxed at the more favorable long-term capital gains rates versus ordinary income taxes, certainly.
Short-term gains, things you've held for less than 12 months, are going to be taxed at really an investor's ordinary income tax bracket, which hopefully, I don't know, depends on the rest of your income situation, but it could be as high as 35% or elsewhere, or even more than that, 39.6 in the current market. So long-term gains, on the other hand, enjoy the benefit of being taxed potentially at a much lower rate.
Yep, and it's important to remember that we're talking, again, about after-tax accounts. It's not like a retirement account where you're only taxed on what is actually distributed, what you actually took out of the account. In an after-tax account, you don't have to actually take the money out of the account to spend it. It's the gain or the loss is incurred upon the sale of a security in the account. So if you're rebalancing in your account and you sell something at a gain and then you go and buy something else but don't take any money out, you will still receive a 1099 that shows the realized capital gains on it. So just be aware of that.
Now, when you're looking at this year-end strategy here, by the way, folks, if you have short-term capital gains, in other words, or capital losses on an asset you've held for less than a year, you can't use that loss to offset capital gain, long-term capital gains in your plan.
Short, long.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break here on the Money Talk program with Donna Allard and Don Sowa. It is the Get Back to Basics Money Talk show here on a Tuesday, as usual. And we will be back, and we're glad you're here with us on AM 790.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we are back. This is the Get Back to Basics program on the Money Talk program Tuesday with Donna Allard and Don Sowa. By the way, just one other thing related to this issue. We were talking about selling stocks to capture losses and to deal with capital gains. And yes, again, if you want to take advantage of it, you have to get long-term capital losses to offset long-term capital gains. You can do that dollar for dollar. One of the benefits, though, is if you do, in fact, have a loss upon the sale of an asset, whether it's short or long, you can actually use it to offset $3,000 of ordinary income in any one given year. a $3,000 loss will actually save you approximately $840 in taxes, assuming you're in the 28% tax bracket. Now, with the advent of something we've talked about here on the program, which is exchange-traded funds, tax loss harvesting has become a little bit easier. If you wanted to take a loss in a particular asset class, you could actually sell a mutual fund and replace it with the corresponding exchange-traded fund and do that for about a 31-day period. Now, that deals with the wash sale. You avoid the wash sale rule. Now, explain, Donna, for purposes of our listeners, explain the wash sale rule a little bit.
So although there are all of these planning opportunities created, one of the things the IRS doesn't want to see us doing is, say, selling Apple today at a loss and then buying it back tomorrow at a gain. I realize that would be very, very short term. But they don't mind strategic planning, I guess we could say, but they're not looking to see people quickly taking advantage of losses in this way to offset.
You have to be taking risk. There's got to be a certain amount of risk.
So before you can buy back the same stock or substantially similar security, and by that means like a mutual fund. So one large like MFS large cap growth fund and then another large cap growth fund, something like that. You can't sell one just to buy another that really could replace it substantially without satisfying the wash sale rule, which is 30 days. So on the 31st day, you can then go and repurchase.
Yeah. So that we stated in the last segment that the allowable period was 60 days, when in fact it's 31 days. Now, tax loss harvesting might also be used for an investment that has perhaps a different tax basis, or what they call various lots. In other words, you purchased, this would be the case of an individual stock, you purchased it a number of different times. Individuals might have actually purchased securities at different times, and depending on the price, may actually have a gain in one lot of their purchases or a loss in another. In situations like this, you can use a method called lot identification, or what they call versus purchase accounting. Now, this is up right now as part of the tax reform package. They're debating this particular issue on individual securities, whether or not you would whether you have to use the FIFO rule. First in other words, the shares that you're selling at any given moment, you have to treat them as if they're the first ones you bought, which may be the ones that are carrying a long-term capital appreciation, which would be taxable, rather than having you go in and use the most recent one you purchased and actually lock in the loss as a result of it, even though your average cost basis may allow you to declare a profit for the entire investment plan.
Yeah, I mean, one of many. That is one of many rules being debated at this time, I suppose. I think most people, when they go in and look at their portfolios, are less likely to be going in and looking at the lots and more likely to go in and look at their average cost basis. That's probably what more people are able to identify with. And the most investors at this point, I'm willing to take a gander, are more likely looking at mutual funds than individual stocks. I know if you have a couple $100,000, that's probably what you're looking at, is using mutual funds for diversification, in which case you would just be looking at an average cost basis.
Now, obviously, most of these strategies that involve you purchasing an asset or selling an asset at year end to take advantage of loss planning or tax planning, the deadline would, of course, be the end of the year. So it would be the last fiscal day in 2000, and this is 2017. You'd certainly want to get that done before year end. But that's not the same rule related to your ability to reduce your taxable income through the use of IRAs or the sort.
To making an IRA contribution? Yeah. Right. So the deadline for making your IRA contribution is, frankly, when you do your taxes. So if you do your tax, if you're, filing your taxes on April 15th or whatever the date happens to be for 2018, I'm not sure where that falls, then you have up until you do then to make the contribution, and you can deduct it on your taxes then. If you're going to do your taxes in February, make sure you make the contribution first so you can mark it on there and don't have to go back in and amend them. But it is matched up with the tax deadline as opposed to the year-end deadline. So if you're looking to for 2017, it's the $5,500 if you are under age of 50, $6,500 if you are over 50. Next year, that's going to go up by $500 each, which is fantastic. If you wanted to kind of get ahead of the game, you can go in January and you can make both at once. So if you are under 50, The limit next year is going to be 6,000, so you could do 5,500 for 2017 and 6,000 for 2018. Get it in, get it all invested, you know, ready to go.
Okay.
Out the gate.
Well, folks, this is the Money Talk program. We do take your calls at 437-5000. That's the local number, and 888-345-0790. Let's head on out to Pawtucket. James, welcome to the Money Talk program.
Hi, Don. I have a question about investing on your own versus a financial planner. Like, I'm looking at a T. Rowe Price 2020 fund. I see the expense ratio, like, 0.63%. And since inception of the fund in 2002, it's returned 8.78. So my question is, why would, if somebody is comfortable investing like that, why would somebody pay, you know, 1 or 1.5% expenses with a financial planner when you could get that at investing on your own?
Let's switch this over to Donna real quick, Jim. I'm going to repeat the question for anybody who didn't hear it.
Sorry, my little adapter
isn't
working,
so isn't
I can't
working well.
Hear yeah, the callers.
Jim is saying that he was looking at the T. Rowe Price. Was it 2020 fund, Jim? The 2020 fund, one of the age weighted.
It's going to be on the conservative side. The balance to conservative.
Yeah, 2020 fund is very, very close to, that would be that 2020 was the date of maturity that you would need that money. That's why a person would choose 2020.
Yeah.
If you were retiring in 2020, that's the fund you would choose. If you wanted to be a little bit more aggressive than that, in other words, say you were not going to be using the money for 10 years, then you could go out to 2025 or even 2030. The difference would be...
There would just be more money on the equity side of the portfolio.
Yeah, there'd be more stocks in there. The longer you go out before you reach that maturity date, James, the higher the percentage you'll have in stocks or equities. Mm-hmm. And the one right now you're having is going to be heavily weighted in bonds at this stage of the game. So... And you went through a piece from 2002 to the present that it did a little over an 8% average rate of return, a period during which bond interest rates were dropping, and the value of bonds were offering better than average returns during that time.
For a significant period of time, you actually saw double-digit returns on your bonds in that fund, and it's progressively gotten more conservative since then.
Well, the interesting thing that James just asked, though, was he says, if that's the case and the expense ratio is, say, 63 basis points, 0.63, he says, why would a person who's willing to invest that way not just contact T. Rowe Price, set up a plan personally through them directly online, which you could do, or you could even just set up a regular online trading account like TD Ameritrade or one of those. You don't have to go directly to the company, and anything that's personally that's publicly traded, you could buy, including any of those T. Rowe Price funds. He wants to know, why would you not do that yourself rather than hiring a financial planner or a broker who's going to charge you maybe 160 basis
points?
Well,
let's be clear. A financial planner and a broker are completely different things.
Yeah.
Like, they don't even belong in the same sentence. Totally different jobs, totally different functions, totally different services. And for some people, you're absolutely right. For some people, that would be fine. One thing I will say is that for most people, the saving side of thing, putting money in, is not terribly difficult. The value of working with a planner is not saying, you know, pick this particular fund and put money in it. A lot of the work that we do with clients, you know, is peripheral to the actual investing itself. It's just one piece of the pie. So part of that, you know, assets under management fee goes for all of the additional planning work and all of the additional help and advice and sounding board and advice with tax planning and working with their estate planning attorneys.
By the way, James, the Department of Labor has encouraged a great many of the big providers of 401ks and 403b plans to have those age-weighted, what we call life stage funds, in their plans, actually not specifically for the reason that you were suggesting, I mean, but for the reason that a great many people in these plans, they may be a wonderful worker within the company that they're working for, but they may know absolutely nothing about investing. So it was sort of the simplified approach to investing, saying pick the date at which you think you're going to retire and then plug your money in there, and it's going to change and adjust periodically over time as you get closer to your retirement age.
Yeah, again, and again, on the when you're putting money in, that's a completely different side of things versus when you actually have to start taking money out. Right?
At the point where you do finally retire, maybe, and you want to turn that thing into an income-producing asset, maybe at that time you might want to sit down with a professional, but I don't have any problem at all if you're comfortable with that approach, with some of your money up front, there's no reason at all not to do that.
I think it's a great option for people.
And you can get a lot of investment
frankly,
advice just by listening to great financial talk shows like the Money Talk program, right, Jim?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. I listen to you guys all the time.
James, do me a favor. Have a fabulous Thanksgiving, okay?
Thanks, and same to you guys.
You're welcome. How are we doing? We all set? We're all, 2 more minutes? Okay, well, with that time frame, we were talking a little bit about also, with all of the other things that you can think about doing, is the possibility of gifting appreciated assets.
You're looking to reduce taxable income possibly through, you already mentioned IRA contributions that you can take down. You have a limit there. Another thing that you can do is obviously gift to charities, right? You're familiar with going to Savers or wherever it is, and you gift clothes or items, and they give you the little tax receipt. Well, you can also gift, if you're over 70 and a half, you can gift directly from your IRA as a qualified charitable distribution to a public charity. And what's great about that is that covers your RMD. So some people who don't need to use their RMD, well, instead you can gift it and not pay taxes on it.
There's also something called the Tax Increase Prevention and Reconciliation Act back in 2005. Gifting highly appreciated assets to someone in a lower tax bracket or a charity, as you mentioned, can effectively reduce or eliminate taxes entirely on highly appreciated assets that you might own within your estate.
So this would be outside of an IRA that you're
talking
about.
Yeah, so due to
now.
Tax laws, if you gift a highly appreciated security to an individual who's maybe in the 10 or 15% bracket, he or she will only be paying, who knows, 0 to 5% capital gains versus what you might have been paying at a higher level, which could be as high as 15% for highly appreciated assets.
So if you want to get rid of your RMD from your IRA without paying taxes, you would do the qualified charitable distribution. And if you have stock that you own that you want to gift
or your non-qualified trust account,
you would do that in the manner you just suggested.
Talk to your financial advisor if you want to reduce your taxable estate and you still want to take care of a family member, somebody you care about, a child, grandchild. This is one of the ways that you can go about doing it. And it's a good idea to get it done this year, at least as part of this year's tax planning, because you could do it with something else again next year.
But remember, that doesn't reduce current income.
It's not about income taxes. This is about estate taxes. Hey, folks, this is the Money Talk program. It's Get Back to Basics Tuesday here as we're coming towards the year end. Donna Soa Allard and Don Soa. That's what we're here for. And we'll be right back after this halftime break.
This is Money Talk with Don Soa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we are back with the second half of tonight's Money Talk program. This is Don Soa with Donna Soa Allard. We've talked about some of the year-end strategies that you could take advantage of. Most of them, in all honesty, are intended to help you reduce your tax liability, and they've fallen into a number of different categories. But sometimes, as you'll notice if you've listened to this program at all, especially on the Tuesday Get Back to Basics series, is really us trying to really, really encourage you to save money, to put away as much money as you're allowed to. And some of the very best savings and investment vehicles that exist out there offer you a number of features, including tax preferential treatment. Let's use that as a term. This time of year is a good time to not only think about reducing your taxable income, but to also take advantage of opportunities to really put a lot of money away if you're able to do so.
Yeah, so if reducing your taxable income is not a huge priority for you because you're not in a high tax bracket, absolutely consider putting money into a Roth IRA. The Roth IRA phase out for couples, it phases out between, I think, $184,000 and $194,000 annually. But, I mean, it's a great way to put money away. And remember, this is money that you've already paid taxes on, and then it grows tax-free. So if you're currently in a low-income tax bracket and you're on the younger side and you really have time on your side, or even if you're a little bit older, but you're looking to put money away that you're not going to have to take out in retirement because there's no required minimum distributions on it. So if you're looking for an opportunity to save money, you have current income, you qualify based on your income levels, you can put money into a Roth and just let it grow tax-free. I always say, the best kind of growth is tax-free growth. After that, we'll take tax-deferred growth. But, if I can let my money grow for years and years and years, I'm 36. So if I can let this money grow for, 30 years tax-free, that's fantastic.
We had a client who sold some property. And after, even after the taxes, suddenly had a little chunk of money available. And as someone who liked to do things very efficiently, the suggestion was, because Donna was just talking about the eligibility to contribute to a Roth, he and his wife together could make $6,500 contribution mm-hmm. each to a Roth. So that's going to be $13,000. And so he had more money than that he wanted to put away. So I said, well, why don't you make one set of contributions for the 2017 tax year right here in December, coming into December.
Okay. Then come back in January.
Then come back 3 weeks, 3 weeks later, and you can put the balance of it in. And if you are positive, also, if you are continuing to be positive about the potential for economic growth, which could extend the rally that we've been enjoying into 2018. We'll be talking about the potential for that in the weeks to come here on Money Talk. But if you feel that there is still momentum here, and that if based on certain conditions happening, maybe even in Washington, D.C., there may be a continuation of not aggressive upside movement, but maybe better than average returns in the new year before we get into a period where we're talking about corrections or pullbacks again.
We've been talking about corrections and pullbacks for so long,
Well, whenever you get to an all-time high in the market, everybody starts talking about that. It's almost like I want to be able to say later on when it eventually happens.
I
told you this was going to happen. But there are some of those major online or television pundits that are out there that have been talking about a correction or pullback for years now. They're starting to really seriously lose credibility. You can only be a bear for so long when you're in a genuinely bullish environment.
I don't even think, you know, suggesting a pullback makes you a bear. I mean, a major correction, yes, perhaps that.
Well, to me, a pullback is a 3-4 or 3-5% decline in value. It's a little bit like releasing the steam valve on a pressure cooker. You don't want the thing to blow up? Well, release the steam valve,
really.
Knock off a couple of percent. It's going to come back.
The analogy I've used with clients recently is those races where you like start at the bottom and run to the top of the Empire State Building. You're going to get to the top one way or the other. But if you start running full steam ahead, partway up there, you're going to have to slow down. You might even have to slow down and take a breath. And then start going again. And that's probably a good analogy of what a pullback represents.
You know, for those of you who are eligible for a Roth contribution, it means maybe you're in a 401k plan at work where you could put a lot more money away, but you're not getting matched. There's no company match. Or you're maxing it out. You may still be eligible to make a Roth contribution. Remember, the money that's in the Roth accounts are, yes, tax sheltered. They're tax-free if you take the money out after you've been in for a specific period of time and you're over 59 and a half. I also like the idea that the spendthrift clause exists in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, which means that the assets in your IRAs, the Roth included, are sheltered from your creditors. The only creditor that you're not sheltered from is who? The Internal Revenue Service. So that means be honest and pay your taxes so that the one creditor who could go into your IRAs or your 401ks or whatever, your tax-sheltered assets, is not going to be chasing after you. I would imagine the lawyers for O.J. Simpson, for all the stupid things he could do, they said, always, always, always pay your taxes, because they're the one guys that could go after that one asset that he's not paying out, which is the 401k plan from the NFL. I mean, how does a guy live as well as he does in that particular environment? You know, Donna doesn't like that story, I don't think. But honestly,
it's like your favorite to bring up.
It's the most important story. It's the poignant story that people understand. They get it. They said, "Oh, okay, I understand that. Yeah, all right." But you know, that said, the Roth is sheltered, and when you get to age 70 and a half, there's no one out there telling you have to take the money out.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you pass away and it goes to your spouse, they also don't have to take a required minimum distribution. If children inherited it, they do, but that's a whole other ballgame.
I've got two clients who are in their 70s now, and they were both, one was a retired principal, one was a retired teacher. They both have very generous pensions. They were part of that original wonderful state pension program.
They retired at the right time.
But they both also contributed fairly aggressively to the degree they could into their 403B plans. They get aggravated every year because they have to take money out of the 403Bs to meet their RMD requirements, and they don't need the money. You should see them. They really want to pull their hair out.
So if it was in a Roth IRA, they would not have to do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Money Talk program. We're going to take one last quick break here before we come back and close out
the hour. We're closed.
This is it.
We're done.
The show? Oh, no.
We're done.
It went by too fast. Well, do we have enough time to wish people a happy Thanksgiving?
Happy Thanksgiving.
Have a happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Good night.